Committee will come to order. Thank you all for being here. We want to be respectful of all those that would like to testify this morning on the omnibus bill, Senate File 27. We are going to try and keep comments to about 4 minutes apiece so we can accommodate everybody on the schedule. If absolutely necessary, we'll come back at 6 o'clock tonight, but we're hoping that people will be brief and not repetitive to other comments and point out provisions specifically where they are either concerned or supportive, and we'll take it in order of the agenda, and with folks being here, we'll move them up as appropriate so that we don't have any holes in the agenda. The first three I'll call up all at the same time will be Jennifer Schaubach from the AFL-CIO, John Thorson from AFSCME Council 5, and maybe we'll hold off on Mr. Knoll until after the two of them are done. So Ms. Schaubach and Mr. Thorson. After them will be Pete Knoll from the Catholic Conference. And then we'll have a group of three, Hesse, Schlander, and Larson. So Ms. Schaubach, welcome to the committee this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Schaubach. I am the Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, which is a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliated unions representing more than 300,000 working men and women throughout the state. Last November, voters of Minnesota were promised jobs, a balanced budget, and new government reforms. No more of the status quo is what they heard. But we're here today looking at a bill that is nothing more than more of the status quo and failed policies of the previous administration. There's no tax reform in this bill, just middle-class tax increases. Just 3 years after a massive financial crisis, profits are rising rapidly, but companies aren't investing. The non-farm, non-financial business sector was holding more than $1.9 trillion in cash in the third quarter of 2010, the highest level since the fourth quarter of 1959, while investment is at the lowest level in more than four decades. Yet the assault on the middle class and the contract rights of our public workers we are seeing are said to be necessitated by our looming revenue crisis. Why are we not also talking about the other expensive government obligations for which the beneficiary is business rather than labor? Tax cuts for businesses have not been translated into an economic boom, and the overall growth of the economy has not been translated into more jobs. If revenues are not raised here in Minnesota, further cuts will continue to ripple through our economy. More teachers, nurses, police, and firefighters will lose their jobs. Funding for crucial services will be cut, and there will be reduced spending in the private sector. How will that help our business? We've heard much about how we all need to make sacrifices and how budget cuts are inevitable. But all this talk of austerity is unseemly in the face of corporations that are gaming our tax system and paying nothing, zero, zip, toward government services they enjoy. Corporate tax avoidance schemes alone cost the U.S. Treasury an estimated $100 billion a year. Based on the percentage of total federal tax revenues that Minnesota taxpayers contribute to the national treasury, our tax burden is almost $3 billion. And this bill seeks to eliminate state property tax for corporations. Tax is the forgotten element in the corporate social responsibility debate and probably the most important. Companies do not make profit merely by using investors' capital. They also use the societies in which they operate, whether it be the physical infrastructure provided by the state or the people the state has educated. Tax is the return due on this investment by the society from which companies benefit. It is time once and for all to get serious and focus on creating jobs and offering real solutions that will solve the structural budget problems of our state. On behalf of the Minnesota AFL-CIO and working families, we ask for you not to support more of the status quo and vote no on this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schaubach. Mr. Thorson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Thorson with the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees, Council 5. We represent 43,000 women and men who provide public services in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to express our concern with Senate File 27. Two concerns, one on each side of the ledger. The first on the spending side of the ledger. We believe $630 million of cuts, additional cuts to aids and credits to local governments, is too much. The cuts, prior to the first dime of cuts in this bill, numbers, an analysis based on the February forecast and price of government, since calendar year 2002 to now calendar year 2011, there's been a $101 million nominal decline in county aid from the state. In constant 2011 dollars, or in a 2011 value dollars, that's $701 million of value that no longer, of state money, no longer supports the delivery of county services. When you account for population growth, that's a per capita decline of 38% support of state for the delivery of county services between calendar year 2002 and 11. For cities, again, numbers based on the February price of government and forecast and price of government, there's been a nominal decline of $144 million between the same period, calendar year 2002 to 11. In constant dollars, that's $561 million of value in today's dollars, or a per capita decline of 42%. So the state local partnership has been stressed, to say the least. The result of these cuts have meant fewer services delivered by fewer workers at a greater cost to property taxpayers. What's filled that gap is about additional $3 billion worth of property taxes, and again, to deliver fewer services with fewer employees. And that's before the cuts contained in Senate File 27. An additional $630 million of cuts to cities and counties will result, again, in fewer services at greater cost with fewer workers. And this is at a time when job vacancy rates, according to the latest Deed study, are there's 206,000 Minnesotans unemployed, competing for 33,800 jobs. And of those, only 20,600 jobs are full-time. Adding to the unemployment rolls at this time is not going to help the economy and the recovery move forward. Our second concern is on the other side of the ledger. The Senate File 27 doesn't approach the state's budget problem, closing a $5 billion gap in a balanced way. There simply isn't the revenue in this bill to, again, approach this in a balanced way. And the revenue not contained in this bill, in addition to the local aids and credit cuts, is also driving the reductions in services in human services, higher ed, Department of Transportation that's being discussed in the other committees. When we finish this discussion and we come to a compromise budget at the end of session, we simply must have a strong and competent government and public sector to get us through this economic recovery.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony, and I can assure you we're all very concerned about the unemployment rates in the state of Minnesota. I'm sure we can all agree on that. We're all concerned. Thank you both for being here. Pete Knoll and Senator Langseth will be added to the agenda as well, and we'll fit him in when he's back. He wanted to testify. Mr. Knoll, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Peter Knoll, Minnesota Catholic Conference Education Director. Thank you for the opportunity, Madam Chair and members, to speak in support of Senate File 764. That would be Article 1, Section 3 of your bill. And essentially, Madam Chair, members, that is a measure that empowers low-income parents in Minnesota by providing them with increased access to the full array of educational options for their children. This measure is designed to help bridge the achievement gap that we've heard mentioned so often in various committees, particularly Education Committee, over the past several sessions. And those of you that aren't aware, the achievement gap is really the gauge by which children of color achieve compared with their counterparts in the overall population. And yesterday, Madam Chair and members, I noted in the Star Tribune the manifestation of the yawning achievement gap. And that says, our black and white jobless gap in Minnesota is the worst in the nation. Our achievement gap is the second worst in the nation. Now, this measure, we're not saying that this is a panacea. It's not going to cure all the achievement gap issues, but it's a step in the right direction, Madam Chair and members, to give kind of level the playing field and give low-income families an opportunity to one more option for them, one more enrollment option for them to choose from. They still have all the other array of options available to them that are accorded within their school districts. This is just adding one more piece to it and giving them another opportunity to find the school that may serve their children well, that they've chosen and that they've decided will best suit the needs of their particular individual children. This measure enjoys a broad support from myriad religious groups and school choice advocacy organizations. By and large, we found supporters within the business community as well. And finally, we just think this is one more innovative effort to try and be a partner in closing the achievement gap. So I would ask that you would stand in support of this, members, as a method of really giving low-income families in particular one more tool in their kit that will really help bridge that achievement gap. Thank you, and I would stand for any questions if you're entertaining questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Knoll. I don't see any at this time, but I appreciate your willingness to answer them.
My pleasure.
We have also Tom Hesse from the Chamber of Commerce, Alyssa Schlander from the Auto Dealers Association, and Jill Larson from the Business Partnership, if you would join us. Mr. Hesse, if you'd introduce yourself, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Madam Chair, first, we just want to thank you for the Senate file that's in front of us today. The statewide property tax reduction and phase-out in the bill certainly will be felt by our members and in Minnesota businesses all over the state. Despite the significant reforms that were enacted in the late 90s and early part of last decade, Minnesota still has a high property tax burden relative to the rest of the nation. And it's partly due to a few things. First, we still classify property to a great extent in Minnesota. So commercial industrial property bears a larger burden compared to homestead property. But second, it's also due to the fact that we have a state property tax, which many other states do not have. Reducing the state general levy, is the most direct way to provide businesses relief, and businesses across the state will appreciate the relief that's contained in this bill. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Mr. Hesse, we have a big agenda, and so I'm fearful if we get into too many questions here, we'll never make it through. So I'll ask if you'll just stay at the table, and we'll let folks maybe with all three of you at the end, if there are a couple of questions, we may have time to entertain that. Ms. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I also just want to go on record saying thank you for the provision in the bill that reduces the state general levy, otherwise known as state business property tax. As Mr. Hesse mentioned, businesses still pay an effective tax rate about three times higher than residential property, and we appreciate the effort made by the committee to provide some direct business property tax relief. Thank you.
Ms. Schlander, good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. I know we have to be brief this morning, so I would just like to say thank you to the committee for their work on this bill and in addressing some of the tax issues that affect small businesses in Minnesota. I generally echo what my colleagues have stated already. Thank you.
Before you leave, hopefully you'll just clarify, there's been some misunderstanding that maybe we were repealing all property taxes for all businesses in the state, and that would not be true, but your members all pay local property taxes and pay the state business property tax on top of that, and our bill would only begin the phase out of that second portion, the statewide. But can you confirm that for members so there's no further misunderstanding about that?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The Minnesota businesses still pay all local property taxes. This state general levy is an additional tax that commercial, industrial, utility, and cabin properties pay.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I thought utilities did not pay the state general tax. Am I wrong?
Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, my understanding is utility generating equipment is not subject to the tax, but I think their real property is probably subject to the tax.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Thank you, Ms. Schlander, Ms. Larson, and Mr. Hesse. And all right, next we have,
thank you all.
I'm sorry. We have Mayor Mark Voxland from Moorhead, who's come a long way, and also Senator Langseth, if you'd both like to testify. Thank you and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Voxland. I'm the mayor of the city of Moorhead. I'm here to talk today about the disparity reduction credits that the city of Moorhead receives. I want to explain to the committee a little bit about the program and ask for your consideration to keep it in state law. In the 1970s, the city of Moorhead saw a major hemorrhage of businesses from the city of Moorhead, Minnesota to Fargo, North Dakota. And hemorrhage is the right word. Many of our very strong local businesses literally moved across the river, a short distance of less than a mile, and received a lot better property tax rate, workman's comp rates, unemployment rates, income tax rates. The way that the state legislature in the early 80s stopped this tremendous flow of businesses outside out of Moorhead was to create this disparity credit program. What the program does is it sets the property tax rate for the commercial and industrial properties in the city of Moorhead and five other communities bordering the state of North Dakota at 2.3%. If our state tax rate dropped below that, that would be the effective rate. If it was above that, like it is at this time, then 2.3% is our effective tax rate. Right now, the state of North Dakota averages about 1.8%. The 2.3% was a very good number up until the tremendous oil boom that North Dakota started a couple years ago. They have redone how they are doing commercial rates, and I believe you have a sheet that's come around that will show you what that rate is doing to taxes on North Dakota properties, commercial and industrial, and it shows what the 2.3% is doing in Moorhead. I am a small business owner, besides being a mayor. A lot of people, I know you aren't of the group, but most people don't understand that mayors and cities either are retired or have a real job besides being mayor, with the exception of Mr. Ryback and Mr. Coleman. My job is, in the real world, is an electrical contractor. I own my own business, and I own the building that we're in. What I see in my own personal business is about a $1,500 a year reduction in my property taxes because of this program. If I were to move 1 mile east, I'd be in North Dakota. I'd have the same sphere of business that I have now, but I would have much less workman's comp, much less income tax, much less property tax, unemployment, everything. One reason I stay, one reason most of the businesses in Moorhead now stay, is because the disparity reduction credit does get close to leveling a playing field for us. There's still some other disadvantages with North Dakota, but by keeping the property tax fairly level, that seems to be the real linchpin that kind of holds it together. We really feel that this program has done a good job for us in stabilizing business. It does not, however, give us an economic development advantage, interestingly enough. If you are a big company and you're looking to locate in the Fargo-Moorhead area, we are hardly ever looked at as a city of Moorhead. And again, it's because of all the other benefits that North Dakota has. Every once in a while we win, but it's just amazing when you look at the phone book in Fargo and you take a look at Moorhead or Minnesota businesses. It's amazing the businesses that you see that never really even looked at Moorhead. And, I mean, we're talking major businesses, Best Buy, Cargill, Dorsey & Whitney, Marvin's, Windows, all are over in the Fargo side. So it's not something that we're using that gives us some kind of a great benefit that will draw outside companies in. This is really a stabilization program for the city of Moorhead. If you have any questions,
I'd be glad to answer them. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Senator
Langs, Madam Chair, well, I was the one that was involved in this many years back. At that time, the city of Moorhead's population was just totally flat, and we were losing a number of businesses. In the last 10 years, Moorhead grew by 18%. Dilworth right next to him grew by 34%. Glennon next to that grew by 33%. The whole thing has swung around. But today we need it more than we ever did because the state of North Dakota has got 650,000 people. They are now fourth in oil production in the United States and will soon be second. They are the only state in the United States that's sitting there with a large surplus. They increased their spending a lot this last biennium, and they lowered their taxes. And every year now, the state of North Dakota produces far more oil than they did before. A higher and higher percentage of their budget comes from oil and coal, and lower percentage comes from their businesses and their citizens. So it's needed more now than ever before. And today, like I say, we not only stabilized, but when it comes to the population, Clay County was the fastest growing county outside the metropolitan area percentage-wise. So it's done a great job. And then some of the things that happened, partly because of the population growth, we have the three very large chain retail stores that came over there on the Moorhead side. And they are paying millions of dollars in state sales tax. So whatever money the state puts out for this program has come back many times over. And, you know, the largest John Deere dealership in the state of North Dakota moved from Fargo to Moorhead. The largest Case International dealer in North Dakota moved from Fargo to Moorhead. Now, they didn't do so because they'd get cheaper property taxes because it's still a little bit higher. But the property taxes are now in that competitive range, and there were other reasons for them to locate in North Dakota, and they were able to do so because of the disparity reduction in credit. So it's really done everything we wanted it to do. It's not only stabilized, it has really caused us to get pretty much the same population increases and so on that the other side of the river. Fargo and West Fargo are far and away the fastest growing communities in the state of North Dakota, and that's what we have to compete against. And so for the future, we're really going to need this program much more than we have in the past simply because of what's happening to the oil and coal revenue over in the state of North Dakota. It makes our border cities much different than any other border cities along any other state within Minnesota. So we need it now more than ever. It's already proven that it's really paid back as far as the state of Minnesota, made us a very prosperous area. So this is simply not the time to be increasing taxes on businesses along the border by, I guess it'd be $6 million a year. So that's it, and I just think it's the wrong way to go.
Thank you, Senator Langseth. Thank you, Mayor Voxland. Appreciate your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mayor, do you have one of these in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Mayor, if you would, could you just, could we just maybe just, so I understand it, follow across, let's just take the $1 million commercial property, if that be. So the gross tax in Moorhead being $35,000, and then does disparities buy it down to $23,000?
That's correct.
Okay. And then you're comparing it 19, 16, and so on, $18,000 across, okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to make sure I understood that.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you again for joining us this morning. Gary Carlson and Patricia Nauman. Nauman, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We represent cities throughout the 7-county metro area. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. And I wanted to first say, Madam Chair, that I appreciate your comments yesterday that outlined your goals for the bill and the clarity that that provided for us. Appreciate that very much. We don't necessarily agree with all of the goals, but we do appreciate the clarity there. And I wanted to start off first just speaking to the provisions of the bill that we do support. First of all, the extension of the TIF provisions from the 2010 jobs bill. We do appreciate that very much. That will allow some cities that have projects in the queue to be able to move forward with those projects so that we can create jobs and grow the economy. So we do appreciate that. We also support moving toward reform of the market value homestead credit as it is presented in this bill to move that program away from a credit in which the cities are on the hook for a state program. So we do support that provision as well. On the TIF provisions, we would hope that you would consider, we did have a TIF provision that would have allowed pooling for market rate housing. That was a Senator Rust bill, and we do hope that you will consider giving consideration to that as you consider any amendments to the bill. I want to speak first to some concerns we have about the fiscal disparities language in the bill that directs the property tax study group to undertake looking at how do we eliminate that program. Our policies do support study of the program, which is now underway. As it was passed last year by the legislature, the Department of Revenue is now tasked with conducting a study. We do support that study and potential improvements to the fiscal disparities program, but we do not support a wholesale repeal of that program, which from the intent of the language, that's where the desire of the committee is to move forward on. We also have some significant concerns about the level of LGA reductions. As we've pointed out before here, we do believe that LGA serves a very important role in the state and local partnership. Cities over the last several years have seen very persistent cuts to both LGA and the market value homestead credit, and we would argue that those cuts have been very disproportionate. You consider that LGA makes up about 3% of the state budget, and the cuts in this bill are at about 22%. We think that's very disproportionate. Metro cities in particular, we believe, have seen very disproportionate loss of aids and credits, 50% over the last 8 years. So we would appreciate, as you look forward to trying to balance the budget with more balanced cuts. I think I'll stop. Answer the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Maybe I can clarify the intent on that fiscal disparities language. Sometimes the work groups will recommend that there be no change, but then the policymakers may still want to hear what it would take to make that change. And sometimes it seems to me that if we had the recommendation about what it would take to eliminate it, we might all be in agreement that that's too extreme and too difficult to do. So it's trying to get that work group to take that review to the next level. And it would actually empower your members if you said the way to eliminate it would be almost impossible. Then we all have more facts, more ability to discuss what it really means to eliminate it, instead of just get back a report that says we think you should keep it or we think you should let it go. It's asking them to do a little more work. That's my intention. And then we can talk about what they say and what it would take to the best way to eliminate it. It might be just too hard for anyone to accept.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, for that clarity. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Is Mr. Carlson in the room? He may have had a board meeting. We'll take him later if he's available. In the meantime, we have Mike Hickey from the National Federation of Independent Business. Is he here yet this morning? I don't see him. Jerry Cortez-Mock, did I say that right? Not here. Rob Eklund, the Coochiching County Commissioner. Commissioner, thank you. And is Todd Beckel, Lake of the Woods County Commissioner, here as well? Commissioners, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You'd like to introduce yourself for the record, and yep. I'm happy to hear from you.
Madam Chair, Senate Tax Committee members, my name is Rob Eklund.
I'm a Coochin County Commissioner. I'm here today to speak in strong opposition to the proposed cuts in the PILT, which are outlined in this proposal. Coochin County relies on PILT payments for 38% of our county budget, and the proposal to cut PILT by 15% and repeal all future inflation payments. Imagine if such a large piece of the state operating budget were cut. Revenues are suddenly sliced by 15%, and on top of that, any chance for future inflationary increases were eliminated. You'd be screaming bloody murder. Pretending that inflation doesn't happen is ludicrous. I wish that you would take a moment and take a fresh look at the why behind what you're doing with this PILT proposal. It appears to me that no one has really looked closely at the legislative auditor's report on PILT that was recently presented to this committee. Numbers in that report clearly show that PILT is not a runaway spending program. Instead, its funding is barely above the CPI since PILT was introduced in 1976. More specifically, of the three major types of land that separate PILT formulas are run on, only the most valuable lands of the three, the acquired acres or 0.75% market value lands, are what are driving the cost of PILT. Let's take a look at what is driving those costs. First, the state continues to be on a spending spree on buying new lands that they cannot afford to maintain, as the DNR's own report has admitted. So why is the state setting such a bad example and not taking personal responsibility for this most fundamental of responsibilities that comes with ownership of land, paying your property tax bill? My message to you is the state should stop buying more land until they start paying their full property tax bill owed through PILT payments. Secondly, has anyone bothered to look at the period of time of the last 5 years of the 0.75% PILT payment occurred? It happened during much of the steepest increase in land values, our recent real estate bubble that has occurred across this, our state and nation. Thus, we will never see another spike in land prices like we have just witnessed, and there simply isn't going to be any 5 million biennial increases on PILT every 5 years like we have just witnessed. In conclusion, if we just apply the CPI to PILT payments since 1976 on the original state-owned land, then PILT payments would be in excess of $17 million. Next, throw in all the additional state lands that have been purchased by the state since PILT began, and the overall PILT payments easily jump to over $20 million. Finally, look at the $5 million increase in PILT inflation payments that just occurred, and almost all of it is due to one and one thing only, the 0.75% acquired acres payment that has happened once every 5 years. The real estate bubble is over. We aren't going to see huge increases in land values like we have just witnessed, I don't believe, again in our lifetimes. In other words, Madam Chair, members, you are proposing to fix a problem that really doesn't exist, restore the 15%, and most importantly, reinstate the inflation adjustments that over time have given us no more than what the CPI has increased by. For a county that relies on PILT revenue for 38% of its operating budget, I do not believe that is too much to ask. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Commissioner, if I could just say, I assure you we have looked at the OLA report, okay, and we did spend some time reviewing PILT payments. We had an overview that we took some significant county or committee time for.
All right.
So. Senator Bob.
Madam Chair, I think I have a question that could be answered with just one word, if that would be okay. Commissioner Eklund, what percentage of the land in Coochin County is publicly owned?
It's a large amount, Senator Bach. I don't know the exact percentage.
Over 80%?
Over 80%, yes. I believe it's about 83, if I'm not mistaken, right in that area.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Todd Beckel from Lake of the Woods County.
Welcome. Madam Chair, Committee. Thank you. Todd Beckel, Lake of the Woods County Commissioner. I'll apologize up front to make this personal, but for me being a commissioner from one of the poorer counties in the state, PILT is very important to us. We end up with just under $1 million a year in PILT payments, but that's a payment for, we have about 487,000 acres, so we get about $2.04 an acre on average. So it's really not a whole bunch per acre. But when you take our county, our local levy is $2.3 million. It's tough for me to make it up when we only have about 3,800 people in the whole county. I understand we have a lot of cuts to make, and we all have to share in the burden. But with the state has a hunger for more land, how are we going to address that for the future? I just see that we're just digging a bigger hole. Until we come up with a plan how we can spread the pain evenly across the area. I mean, when we talked about the auditor's report, we have in the state just under 8.5 million acres in our state. Last year it cost us $21 million. As a landowner, as the state is a landowner, we have rights and responsibilities, and that's one of them is you have to pay your taxes. If we want to spread it around and put 90,000 acres in every county so we can all share in the burden equally, I don't know how we do that. But until we get to that point, we have to protect PILT to help them smaller counties that have large public land bases. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Thank you for joining us. I know you've come a long way. We have Ralph Donay, the United Veterans Legislative Council of Minnesota, and Dan Severson, who are both here to testify on the bill as well. Mr. Donay, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank all of you again for giving me the honor of leading the Pledge of Allegiance on Monday in your chambers. I'm here this morning to ask you to think of the second career military in a little bit different light. Think of them as being a business coming to Minnesota that can bring up to a half a billion or more dollars into our state's economy. We're told from the people that deal in numbers and figures that that money turns over 4 to 6 times in the state's economy because it's money that's brought in from outside of the state. So think of our second career people as being another business coming to Minnesota. What would you do to bring that business into Minnesota to bring more money into our economy? These people that come in, think of it, they don't need any medical care. It's all paid for by the federal government. The employees are well educated. They're proven leaders. The monies that they bring with them now under the new current GI Bill will go into Minsky immensely because now their sons and daughters and wives can go to college under the current GI Bill. It's something that was unheard of in the past. Another thing I'd like you to consider is that we're talking an average yearly income for the second career folks that are currently here is only $19,200 from their pensions. It's not an exorbitant amount of money. And lastly, I'd like to remind you that as you get ready to get out of the military and come back to wherever you're going to move, the Transition Assistance Program points out everywhere you go in the United States what states have what taxes on their pensions. And right away, Minnesota is at the top of that list of one of those that doesn't want to do anything for the second career folks. And it's unfortunately, my son-in-law is getting ready to retire from the Marine Corps, and I don't think my grandchildren and my daughter are going to come back to Minnesota. And when I ask him why, he says, it's because of the tax, Dad. So thank you for allowing me to testify this morning. If you have any questions, I've given all of you this sheet before that shows where Minnesota is, how much more money Wisconsin's bringing in. It's over $200 million since 2001 that they have gained into their state budget over Minnesota's budget. So thank you all. If you have any questions, you know where to find me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donay. Representative Severson, welcome back to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thanks for this opportunity. Just a kind of a final plug, just to put in a few other words. Mr. Donay has done a great job of outlining this, but this is really an intellectual property recruitment tool. Several years ago, this committee had a CEO from Northrop in here who was giving testimony as to why this was such an important move, because they look for these type of people who get out of the military and then are looking for a job typically making six-figure incomes. And that is one of the big obstacles here is just as Mr. Donay had said, we are one of 5 states that currently tax our military retired pay. In fact, we are supposed to have about twice as many retirees in the state. Should have about 32,000 retirees in the state. Currently, we have about 16. And this is a direct effect of the TAP class of the because these individuals learn where the best advantage for them is to move. before they get out and as they're making their decision to move to. Now, one of the other things I think that the committee needs to consider is these individuals typically come with spouses who are highly educated as well. And they have a second career, they have a career salary that they're bringing with them. They're purchasing new homes in the area, which have an extremely high rate of volunteerism. And I believe that it is in a economically challenging time. This is one of those incentives that is well worth making a minimal sacrifice to try and draw these people into the great state of Minnesota. This is a great provision. We've had it here for a number of years. In 1978, we had it, and then it was taken, that provision of tax exemption was taken out. We can reinstate that and we can fix that, and I think we can begin to see a new surge of military retirees coming to this state. And I would stand for any questions, ma'am.
Thank you, Representative Severson. We have a pretty big agenda, gentlemen, yep. And there may be questions from individual members when we're done here. I didn't see Mr. Hickey, Mr. Jerry Cordes-Mackey from the London Road Rentals from Duluth. No, not yet. Harry Roca from Pocket Your Dollars and Connie Berg from Flamingo World. She's not here. Welcome, Ms. Roca.
Good morning. My name is Carrie Hosh, and I'm the owner of a website, pocketyourdollars.com, and I'm just here to express my appreciation that the committee has excluded the affiliate nexus tax from the current bill. I'm a small business owner, and in 2010, 45% of my family's income was generated through affiliate marketing. And so obviously the passage of that tax would have a huge impact not only on my family, but I also provide part-time employment to 12 individuals. So if that tax were to pass, I would be impacted as well as my family, but it would result in layoffs of those that are working for me, but it would also result in a decrease in service. PocketYourDollars.com, which started as a personal blog but is now a very popular website, in the 2 years it's existed, has helped more than 500,000 Minnesotans learn cost savings techniques that have helped them to stretch their family's budget. And if this tax were introduced and passed, then it would decrease the ability. I would have to get another job, and it would decrease the service I could provide, which certainly would push some number of the families that are benefiting from this service over the edge onto public assistance, where they won't be able to just make do with the money that they have. And, you know, just for in closing, I'll share two quick stories of people who have told me how the service has impacted them. One woman, after discovering Pocket Your Dollars and the cost savings measures that she was able to take part of, told me she could now afford to buy her lupus medication, which, you know, obviously would be a priority, but is something she couldn't afford and now could. And if this service went away, she would be without. Another woman, an Anoka County employee, after hearing some training, said in the first 7 weeks she learned and some things and then saved enough money to afford a month's worth of daycare for her family. So I'm just appreciative that this committee is not eliminating that service for the state of Minnesota and not causing me to have to lay off staff. So I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. And can you state your name again? Because we
it's Hasha. It's Portuguese, so you won't. It's not phonetic.
I see. Yep. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mayor Cook, are you ready to speak? Thank you. And then we'll have Ernest McNeil, if he's here, from Plymouth. Mayor Cook, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. First, I just wanted to thank you for including the Hutchinson sales tax in the proposed bill. I think with our announcement a week and a half ago, it's even more important than it was before, you know, to address some of the issues that we're facing. And I also want to thank you for including language in the bill to provide cities with the opportunity to have a local option sales tax, you know, within certain parameters. I just think that makes it a lot easier for everybody, the cities as well as the legislature going forward. And so, again, I thank you with that. I did want to just raise some concerns about the provisions for the LGA offset, though. I think all these types of projects that cities come forward, you know, from the capital ends really are above and beyond the types of things that we use LGA for, which is more services and maybe maintenance of some capital things. So I think then to have the LG offset, it's really counterproductive to city's ability to provide those services. And so I just ask that you reconsider that. I think, again, these projects have a regional and broader benefit, and that's why a local sales tax is really a fair and reasonable way to do that in lieu of maybe bonding or property tax increases. And all the services and programs that LGA still provides and is used for, they're still there, even if these projects are done, you know, through the local sales tax. So, so again, just ask that you reconsider that part of it. And then also, I noticed that there's a limit in the bill for local option sales taxes of 10 years. I would just ask that you consider extending that to 15 or 20 years. I think just looking through some of the existing local sales taxes, there's a number that are 10 years or less, but there's a number that are much longer than that. So I think, again, it just would make it a lot easier for cities and the legislature to extend that out so that cities don't have to come back and ask for that extension or longer time period as part of a special bill. And finally, just as far as the LGA, just wanted to echo what Patty Nauman had mentioned about the disproportionate cuts that cities have experienced recently, and that is you consider balancing the budget and LGA is going to be impacted, that we try to be look for ways to do it in a more proportionate manner in relation to the whole budget and be a little fairer that way if at all possible. So thank you.
Mr. Mayor, I do have a question. Do you know whether Hutchinson receives the regional center aid or the jobs-based aid portion of the LGA payments?
Yeah, we do. Madam Chair, we do get the regional center aid. The job-based, I think that's all part of every city is eligible for that under the current bill. So,
thank you. I appreciate your comments. And I was just going to say there are others that have also raised the same question about the 10 years and whether it's sufficient to raise the revenue to pay for 20-year bonds.
Right.
And we will probably hear more about that tomorrow when folks offer amendments.
Okay. And I did send out an email, you know, to everybody about just some thoughts on LGA, and I know some of it included like levy limits, and which you're not looking at, but the House apparently was, and if the two bills come together as part of the conference committee, I know that'll be part of the discussions again as well, and just really ask that you not include that in the final bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor. Questions for the mayor? Mr. Ernest McNeil from Plymouth. Welcome, sir, to the committee.
Oh, thank you. I'm here today to speak on the renter's credit.
Yes, sir.
And I live in Section 8, and there's about 39 units. And the people there, you know, we don't have much money. We rely on the renter's credit, you know, at the end of the year. You know, it just helps us out a lot. You know, for a doctor bill that we've been struggling with all year, automobile tabs, you know, things like that. And, you know, and even food, because a lot of people don't get the benefits of food stamps or anything like that. And so, you know, the renter's credit is, the money that we get is so little, it goes right back in the community. So to cut it is just, you know, why take from the poor? And so I'm just, you know, really concerned about that. Now, 1 year they cut it a percentage, and then the next year you may get the full benefit. You know, well, that's fine with me. You know, I have no problem with that. But to take it away from us is just, you know, it's just no good. So that's all I wanted to say today.
Mr. McNeil, thank you for coming today to testify.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Mr. Carlson, Gary Carlson, do you have time to testify now? Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for your patience. We have a group of city, county, and school officials in St. Paul today. About 600 are down at the Radisson or the Crown Plaza, and I had a presentation to make down there this morning, so thank you for your patience. Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm here today to support parts and oppose parts of the bill. Let me start with Article 2, Sections 9, 11, and 13, the new local sales tax authority. We've worked with Chair Ortman and others over the last couple of years on language to authorize cities to impose a local sales tax. We understand the equity issues around sales taxes. We generally support the basic concept of allowing cities to, at their local discretion, impose a local sales tax with voter approval. We do, however, have concerns about the LGA offset piece of this, and let me try to explain these. And I also want to note that I'm still studying, and I've gotten some information from Jack Paulson on the LGA offset, and I'm still trying to understand the full implications of that. But one basic idea, one basic problem we have is that the LGA program provides cities with general fund revenues that can be used for any city operation. The sales tax is dedicated toward capital projects like civic centers, convention centers, public safety facilities, libraries. Those are capital projects. So we would be taking money out of the city's general fund through the LGA offset in exchange for the ability to use monies from a local sales tax for local capital projects. So we do have some concerns about that piece, and I would like to work with the author to try to remedy those concerns. Our city's wish list would include an optional local referendum. I just want to put that on the table. I know that I've talked with Chair Ortman about her desire to have a mandatory referendum. Our city wish list included an optional referendum. I understand her rationale for including the mandatory referendum. Moving on to Article 3, Sections 4 and 5, the market value homestead credit conversion, I'd like to testify in support of those changes in the bill. As we've testified earlier this year, you know that the market value homestead credit program has not been fully funded except 1 year since the creation of that program, and many of our cities have had annual cuts in that reimbursement. The challenge our cities face is that that reimbursement reduction really essentially comes out of their property tax levies as they certify those levies. We've been looking for a solution. We had ideas about trying to match the credit with the appropriation funding level. That's very difficult to do given that we frequently make retroactive cuts to the program. And we do now support this elimination of that program with the full understanding that we understand the implications of shifting taxes to all types of properties and the fact that even homeowners would see a tax increase because of that elimination. But we do support that change. Under Article 3, Sections 8 and 22, the market value homestead credit and LGA cuts, I must respectfully oppose those cuts. As we've testified earlier in this legislative session, those cuts are challenging for our cities, and I would like to remind members and maybe highlight for new members that last year when we put together the state budget, there were cuts that were imposed on cities into this current upcoming biennium, into the 12-13 biennium. LGA appropriation and market value homestead credit was cut by a total of $56 million last year. Senator Bach reminded me that that would not be remembered by committee members last year, and I'm here today to remind you that cities have given their share into cuts already based upon last year's actions, and we feel that that coupled with the cuts that we've experienced since 2008, and those cuts have totaled $310 million to cities since the 2008 unallotments, we feel that that's enough for cities in the budget balancing efforts of the state. We do support the Article 3, Section 30 consolidation grant idea. That's $3.5 million to give cities and counties money to discuss and plan for collaboration consolidation efforts. We think that sometimes the hurdles that cities overcome or need to overcome just to begin discussion of consolidation is sometimes a challenge, and some money up front would be a good stimulus to help discussions get underway. And then finally, a couple of other issues. In the Article 5, Section 2, we support the one-year extension of the TIF districts to accommodate the slow economic recovery. We actually asked for 2 years in the initial bill, but we think the one-year extension would be very helpful. I think Patty Nauman from Metro Cities mentioned the TIF pooling for market-rate housing. We also support having included that in the bill. It's not in the bill as I understand it right now. And finally, Madam Chair, I would like to compliment you and thank you for not including levy limits in this bill. I know I usually don't testify on something that's not in a bill, but we do feel that the levy limits are unnecessary. They're a complication for our members. Sometimes they can actually stimulate local levies. And we applaud you for not including any sort of a levy restriction. We think our cities have proven that they can adjust their levies according to the market and needs of their local communities, and they don't need state involvement in deciding how to set their local levies. Madam Chair, with that, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson, for your testimony and your work on in the development of the bill. I appreciate so much all the cities have done to help us. A question, though, I from the way I look at it, we have not made any further reductions to LGA prior to the 2010 reductions, and I'm hoping you'll just confirm that because that's my understanding of what we accomplished here.
I'm so, Madam Chair, you're asking if these cuts are identical to basically where we were at the end of 2010. That's how I understand it. These cuts are no deeper than what was in House File 130, which was essentially an extension of the level of LGA payments and market value homestead credit payments at the end of all the cuts that were imposed in the 2010 legislative session.
Thank you. I appreciate the confirmation on that. Other questions for Mr. Carlson? Mr. Carlson, thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Carolyn Jackson from the ACLU. And after that, we'll have Bruce Zumbelin from the Minnesota Forestry Association, if he's here. Ms. Jackson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Carolyn Jackson, and I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota. The ACLU of Minnesota is funded and supported by over 8,500 members statewide. Our mission is to defend the constitutional rights under the United States and Minnesota constitutions. You have my written testimony, so I'll just give you the highlights. We oppose Article 1, Section 3 of this bill because it's a tuition tax credit, and tuition tax credits violate the Minnesota Constitution and civil rights. A lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of a law like the tuition tax credit can cost upwards of $2 million. As you consider tuition tax credits, take the cost of a constitutional challenge into account of the cost of the bill. The grounds of the lawsuit would come from the constitutional violation and the impact on civil rights. The tuition tax credit violates the Minnesota Constitution in two ways. First, the Article 3, Section 1 of the Minnesota Constitution requires a general and uniform system of public schools. Because private schools are not subject to the same curriculum and teacher standards as public schools, private funding of private schools violates the uniform system of schools requirement. They also violate Article 13, Section 2, which states that in no case shall any public money or property be appropriated or used for the support of schools wherein the distinctive doctrines, creeds, or tenets of any particular Christian or other religious sect are promulgated or taught. This provision goes farther than the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment and directly prohibits the use of public funds to support schools where doctrines, creeds, or tenets of any religion are promulgated or taught. By providing public funds for some students to attend private religious schools, tuition tax credits would unconstitutionally advance religion. About tuition tax credits would work the same way as vouchers, so the law would be the same. You can't indirectly do what you are directly prohibited from doing. So if we're prohibited from vouchers, we're similarly prohibited from tuition tax credits. In that manner, private schools, it would also threaten civil rights. Private schools are exempt from many civil rights laws, including the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and the Fair Student Dismissal Act. Therefore, tuition tax credits could result in state-funded discrimination. Private school tuition tax credits will not benefit public education in Minnesota. Tuition tax credits would send public funds to private schools while doing nothing to improve the public schools. For these reasons, we respectfully request that you defeat the tuition tax credits, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. I appreciate your testimony, and just like every other lawyer in the whole world, we may have a different view of the constitutional implications for that program, and I'm sure that every other lawyer would have a different view than you and I and could maybe come up with a different approach. But I appreciate your testimony and your advocacy.
And just for the record, win or lose, it would still cost the state money. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Jackson, and I'm just curious, because I don't know the answers. I'm not setting you up. Other schools across the country, other states across the country have or offer tuition tax credits in this kind of a fashion. And if they do, are they able to do it because their constitution is slightly different in terms of the language here?
Ms. Jackson.
Yes. Yes. Tuition tax credits and vouchers have been defeated in states that have constitutions similar to the Minnesota Constitution. For instance, Wisconsin does not have this type of constitution, so they have vouchers, but we do in Minnesota. So there's a difference.
Okay.
Senator
Thank you very Sanchum much.
And Ms. Jackson, though, there is a distinction between a voucher and a tax credit because the voucher incents someone to move to a private school, where a tax credit is a payment after the fact, after the parents have already made all those choices. So there are some legal distinctions as well as practical distinctions between a voucher system and a tax credit system. Ms. Jackson?
Yes, but the challenge would be the same. So.
Is that in court? It is indirectly the same.
Yeah, it is.
Paid in a different way.
Mr. Zumbelin from the Minnesota Forestry Association, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Bruce Zumbelin, Chair of the Government Relations Committee with the Minnesota Forestry Association, the state's oldest conservation organization founded in 1876 to promote stewardship of Minnesota's forests. We pursue that mission through our educational activities and advocacy for family woodland owners with the goal of encouraging them to retain and manage their properties in a sustainable manner. The Sustainable Forest Incentive Program is very important in that role. This program has greatly helped woodland owners afford to manage their properties in the face of rising property taxes and pressures to subdivide or develop or sell their properties. I speak for the small woodland owners regarding Article 3, Section 31 of the Omnibus Tax Bill that repeals Chapter 290C, the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program. Based on recent figures from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, 2,100 landowners, small landowners, owning 394,000 acres have committed to, one, managing their property under a management plan, two, follow Minnesota's site-level forest management guidelines when they do carry out management activities, and three, recording a covenant on the property's deed that restricts the woodlands from being developed. Without the program's annual incentive, a number of owners have told me that they would likely be forced to sell their woodlands. And yes, there is a handful of forest industry or corporate owners that have enrolled their forested properties in the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program. Their participation in the program is important, too. It helps justifying, keeping, and managing their woodlands that support local wood-based economies and the woodlands that also provide the setting for much of Minnesota's tourism industry. Finally, I want to point out that by eliminating Chapter 290C, the Sustainable Forest Incentive Program, it puts into question the foundation of the 2C managed forest property classification found in Section 273.13, Subdivision 23, that requires a forest management plan based on the requirements of Chapter 290C in order to receive a reduced assessment. Unless you have some other questions for me, Madam Chair, that concludes my remarks, and I appreciate you considering my comments.
Mr. Zumbelin, did I say that right?
That's right.
Yeah, and members, Chair. I've asked our counsel to look into what he's just raised with that classification issue, and we'll do further research on that. And I appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Madam Chair,
Senator
I think this is a question for counsel. When people enroll their land in this SFIA program, they go down to the county courthouse and put a covenant on their deed that they won't subdivide that property for 8 years. If we get rid of the program, what happens to the covenant on the deed? Does the bill address that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, the bill does address that in the effective date of that provision. where it provides that the covenants are essentially ended when the program ends.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Zimbalman. Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Intercounty Association.
Madam Chair, I have a hand up, please.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll start while this gets handed out.
Thank you.
I want to start by thanking the chair and the committee for a couple of items. First, along with the cities, counties are thankful that there are no levy limits in this bill. Counties in particular, I think, have more than aptly demonstrated their sensitivity to the current economic circumstances of their taxpayers by having the lowest levy increase this year among any level of government. In fact, nearly 25% of counties in the state of Minnesota either froze or reduced their levies this year. So we think we've shown more than aptly that we can manage our own affairs with regards to our financial circumstances and those of our taxpayers. Also want to repeat the city's testimony thanking you for finally addressing the issue that's existed with the market value homestead credit, where one amount appears on the statement and what is actually paid by the state has been a different amount consistently for 9 out of the past 10 years. For us, it's the same as a property tax delinquency, and the fix that's in this bill finally addresses that issue once and for all. Also want to note the consolidation grants. We appreciate that they're in here. We would ask that you consider broadening the grants to cooperative activities as well as outright consolidations. Both bear fruit in terms of reducing outlays, providing economies of scale to the taxpayers without having to go through the totality of a consolidation of local government units. And frequently, the shared services can be between different levels of government, between counties and cities, counties and school districts and cities, and so on. And so I strongly encourage you to consider broadening the purposes for which those grants can be used. I do want to express a couple of concerns. First, with regards to the payments in lieu of taxes, you've already heard from Kuching and Lake of the Woods counties that represent the two counties with the largest impact in terms of their levies. I'll just highlight that there are three other counties, Lake, Cook, and Aiken, that take very relatively large hits in terms of what this means relative to their levy aid base, running from 3.2 to 2.9% of that, and also St. Louis County that takes the largest cut in dollar terms, and this is really compounded by them by the cuts or elimination of the disparity reduction aid. Finally, mention the handout that I've distributed highlights an issue that we would request that we receive some relief from. In this bill alone, counties are suffering over $100 million of cuts. On top of the $230 million of cuts that we've suffered over the past 4 years, we obviously don't welcome those, but understand what has to be done to meet the committee's targets. But we're looking at additional cuts in other committees within the Senate of over $30 million this year. We do need some relief from what are called the maintenance of effort requirements in current law, which literally requires us to spend over $224 million for mental health and library purposes this current year. With the cutbacks that we're suffering in the aid categories that I enumerated, if we could get some relief in these categories, it would assist us in making the needed cuts to accommodate the cuts that we're suffering in this committee as well as the other committees. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer some questions.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, do you have specific proposals, language amendments to address these maintenance of efforts for the individual committees that will be hearing these substantive issues?
Madam Chair, we have given language to
Senator Hahn that specifically addresses the mental health maintenance of effort. The House tax bill has a suspension of all maintenance of effort requirements that do not have an impact on the state fiscally, and both the library maintenance of effort and the mental health maintenance of effort are included with that. I've shared language with the committee administrator and would like to talk with you later about some options in this area.
Mr. Carlson, I don't want to get in trouble with my colleagues, but are you saying that that's in the House bill?
The House bill,
the House tax bill,
Madam Chair, does have a suspension of the maintenance of effort requirements for a two-year period.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Michelle and then Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just another follow-up request for you, Mr. Carlson. On the, you've got three categories here on the handout. On the child care maintenance of effort, if you have some materials, if you could share those with me or my office, I'm particularly interested in how we're trying to put together an early childhood package of programs, and that runs into multiple committees and jurisdictions, but it would help me to have the benefit of that background, so I'd ask for that.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Carlson, when the maintenance of effort requirements are relieved or eased, does that affect anybody, or is this just a numbers thing? Does that actually affect delivery of service to anybody?
Madam Chair, Senator Pogemiller, it potentially will. Basically, easing the maintenance of effort requirements gives the county or the city, in the instance of the library maintenance of effort, a number of cities are also subject to it, the flexibility to budget their funds as local needs dictate. Right now, the first dollar that we levy is to meet our maintenance of effort requirements, so they come before everybody else. So mental health clientele comes before the developmentally disabled, before abused and neglected children, before the elderly, before other disabled individuals in our social services budget. I'm sure if they came before the committee, they would tell you their needs are as great as the mental health clientele, but state law has identified a priority to mental health. So service reductions are possible, but given the financial circumstances that we find ourselves in, we have to have the flexibility to budget as local needs dictate.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Pogemiller.
You've already testified that counties have held their property taxes the lowest of anybody. So was there a reason somebody thought there should be a maintenance of effort requirement for some of these things? Or was it just kind of fun for the committees to do that in the legislature?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogemiller, there obviously was a reason, since this is state law, that
and what might that reason have been, do you think?
Well, you know, from my perspective, from county's perspective, it's because certain constituencies were successful in making getting the legislature to establish priorities for their specific programs, putting libraries ahead of police and fire, again putting mental health again in front of abused and neglected children, in front of the developmentally disabled, in front of the elderly. Again, the people who make this actual spending decision, it would be our point of view, are the ones who should make that determination, not a third party, the legislature in this instance.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I do know that the counties have come forward and said that there were some efficiencies that they could implement in some of these programs, but the maintenance of effort requirements were keeping them at artificially high levels of funding, and the levels were keeping them from saving the taxpayers money. And I know that's what we're talking about here, Senator Pogemiller.
Well, I understand, Madam Chair, but I simply am not aware that our services to the mental health community are overfunded. I just am not aware that that's the case.
Well, Senator Pogemiller, you may be exactly right. But I think the conversation we're having is, shouldn't the county commissioners
that represent those folks and raise the property taxes be the ones to determine how best to spend those funds and not to have artificial limits from the legislature. I think that's the conversation we're having. Mr. Carlson, thank you. Joe Matthews from the Association of Minnesota Counties, I'm sure he might like to weigh into this conversation.
Madam Chair, I was testifying on behalf of both organizations. Mr. Matthews is at the same conference as Mr. Carlson.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. We have Al Heim, the Roseau County Assessor from the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Are you here, sir? And then we'll have Mike Hickey, who has arrived since. Welcome.
You might not be comfortable with what they do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, members of the committee. My name is Alan Heim, Al Heim. I'm the Roseau County Assessor, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. I'd like to address some bill language that has been proposed. The language can be found on pages 55 and 59. The language deals with the granting the authority to hear and act on appeals with regard to the denial of green acres. Currently, local boards of appeal and equalization have the authority to make changes on a property's value and classification. Green acres is neither a valuation issue nor a classification issue. Green acres is a complex and involved program that, as I'm sure you're all well aware, based on the amount of time that has been spent on the Green Acres issues these more recent years. Much of the reasoning behind the time that we've spent on Green Acres is because of the reported inconsistencies and the inequalization between counties with regard to the application of Green Acres. That numbers, of course, 87 counties. Can you imagine the inconsistencies that would result if you granted the authority to approve or deny Green Acres to 1,876 townships in more than 800 cities? In the late 1990s, there was something of this. It's very similar to this exact issue. There was approximately 20 applications for Green Acres that were denied in the city of Maple Grove. Six of those property owners made an appeal to the local Board of Appeal and Equalization. Because of the political pressure that was placed on the local Board of Appeal, the local board opted to approve the Green Acres for these six property owners. An example of inconsistencies, as you recall, there were 20 applicants that were denied, six made an appeal. What of the other 14 that didn't come to the local Board of Appeal and Equalization? In closing, as noted earlier, the Green Acres is a very complex and involved program requiring many resources and much expertise. There is a tremendous amount of time and resources. There has been a tremendous amount of time and resources spent on Green Acres in order to make it more understandable and its application more equitable. I would strongly urge you to reconsider the language and choose to have the authority to approve or deny Green Acres left with your county assessors. Do what we can to maintain some consistency in the application of the program. The Minnesota Department of Revenue has prepared much training, much information for the counties across the state, and is also our overseers in order to make sure that we are applying the Green Acres properly and consistently. And I would ask again that authority be left with the county assessors. Thank you very much for your consideration. And any questions I would...
Members, any questions for Mr. Heim? Thank you for your testimony this morning, Mr. Heim.
Thank you.
I have. Okay, Ms. Rakow. And we also have Mr. Hickey, I think, on the same topic. Do you want to join us? Different topic. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NIOP, representing commercial real estate developers, owners, and managers of commercial real estate, along with the thousands of tenants that occupy the buildings in the commercial and industrial area that we own and manage. And I just want to say on behalf of all business property taxpayers across the state, thank you for including the phase-out of the state general levy in your Senate bill. And this is important because this is one tax that all businesses pay, whether they're big, small, whether they make money, whether they don't make money, including all of the small businesses in the large buildings that have a higher value. And this also, if a business owns their building, they pay for this. And if they lease in a building, they pay this tax. So this, and this is a tax that's a fixed cost. So if we can reduce fixed costs on businesses, hopefully this they will be able to generate economic activity, and this capital then might be used for expansion. It could be used to hire additional people. And, of course, when businesses expand and more space is needed, eventually we will be able to start building some more commercial and industrial buildings. So I just want to say thank you so much for including this in your bill.
Thank you, Ms. Rakow. Now we'll take Mr. Hickey and Mr. Cordes-Amaki.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, thanks so much for the chance to talk today. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, and we have a member of ours who drove all the way from Duluth and wasn't stopped by the storm from yesterday, Jerry Cordes-Amaki. And if it's okay, Madam Chair, Chris Raddatz wanted to make just a couple brief comments from the Farm Bureau. But I wanted to make a few supportive comments. As you know, National Federation of Independent Business is the largest business group in terms of entities with about 12,000 members and the preeminent small business group here at the Capitol. I wanted to make just a few brief comments about the bill. As Ms. Rocco said, we really appreciate the phase out of the statewide portion of the commercial property tax. This is really going to help a lot of businesses that are struggling and have this very big fixed cost to pay no matter how they're doing. And I've looked at various statements. I think it ranges from about maybe 20% to 33%. And so this is going to certainly help people, and something that we're still very uncompetitive on despite the progress we made in 01. Our level or rate of commercial property taxes is usually top 10 in the comparisons I've seen with $1 million, $25 million property. Also wanted to go a little more in depth on the conformity piece to the estate tax for certain small business and farm equipment. Really appreciate this being put in the bill. This is a proposal we developed with the Minnesota Farm Bureau, the Minnesota Farmers Union, the Minnesota CPAs Association, and former Revenue Commissioner Ward Innes back in 07. And it's critical for us to get conformed to the federal exemption. Our goal is if a small business or farmer does not have federal estate tax liability, they will not have state estate tax liability. And I really appreciate this being placed in the bill. A small part of this was carried forward by then Tax Chair Ann Lachesky back in 07. And so I really appreciate you elevating this critical provision. As you know, small businesses struggle with the planning, and farmers struggle with the planning, trying to keep family traditions and commerce going, trying to pass on the family-held business and farm. These businesses are important to the community. They're important traditions and commerce. And a lot of small businesses and farms play way too much defense on this issue, worrying about when that day of transition comes, buying excessive amounts of life insurance, getting involved in trusts that maybe they wouldn't have to if we simply had an exemption. And so I'm going to turn it over to Jerry, and I'm so glad he could make it today, and he's going to just briefly tell you a little bit about his situation.
And thank you for allowing me this opportunity. This is an issue that's near and dear. I've been going at the American Rental Association. We've had a lot of support nationally from the NFIB to Washington, D.C., trying to get some stability in this area of planning. I own London Road Rental Center in Duluth, Minnesota. I'm currently trying to buy it. I am buying the property that the business sits on. I'm not a rich person. That's the big misnomer, I think, that people see on this law, that it only affects the rich. My wife and I didn't inherit anything. We've built this business. And the way that things have been with the instability, unfortunately, there's a whole other market with the lawyers and the tax planners that have come out of it that are taking away what our grandchildren or our children, we're working hard to do. The rental business is a unique business. I started my own, but about 30% of the rental companies nationwide are second generation. So this is almost, I think farms are the only one that's higher in what goes to a second generation. So our American Rental Association has a whole branch that does nothing but help the second generation to turn things over and such. And this great proposal sure helps that and would make things easier. So I'm just here to talk in support of it. It's when tragedy happens more than anything, when if I were to have a heart attack or something, and I'm not a rich person, but there's enough assets there, it would be terrible that my children would have to hawk it to continue the business, as opposed to being able to smoothly continue the business, keep people employed, keep money in the economy in a better sort of way. It makes sense to have it the same as the federal. So I'm just here talking in support of that.
Thank you very much. Sir, is your business along the Marathon route on London Road?
My house is at the halfway point, and my business is at about the 21-mile mark. So.
I thought. I've been by there a few times, so I hope to come run by again.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Raddatz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity. Chris Raddatz, Director of Public Policy for Farm Bureau. As Mr. Hickey said, we've worked with his organization and Farmers Union. It's been a big issue for us. As the previous testifier, it's generational transfer of farms. And just as a side note, we're seeing increased values of farmland. There was recent sales in Nicollet County, $6,000 an acre. In fact, a farmer in Nicollet County said that his assessed values of his land went up more this year than what he paid for the land when he first started farming. So we're very supportive and appreciative of putting the provision in your bill, and thank you for that.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. We have Charlie Kite from School Administrators and Jen Alswager, if she's here, from Education Minnesota. Mr. Kite, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. You're going to get a three-for-one deal here because I think Scott Kroonquist is coming up as well. And I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And Scott and I speak briefly. We're also speaking on behalf of Education Minnesota and the Minnesota School Board Association. Maybe I'll ask Scott to start.
Thank you, Mr. Kroonquist. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and we appreciate the opportunity to offer a couple comments. We do come to you today to speak in opposition to Article 1, Section 3 of the bill. It's the provision that would provide for tax credits for private school tuition. As you know, this would come at a cost of about $11 million over the biennium. Last night, members, the Education Committee adopted its omnibus bill, and it had a cut target of about $11 million. So in other words, your public schools are looking at $11 million in reductions for the next biennium, and at the same time, this provision would look at providing an $11 million increase in a tuition tax credit. We believe, members, that it's the state's duty under the Constitution to provide a general and uniform, thorough and efficient system of public schools. The Constitution does not place an obligation for you to provide that similar system for private schools. We have nothing against private schools. They perform a very valuable service, but the state does not have an obligation to provide funding for them. Under the Senate target, and which in the House and Governor, quite frankly, have a similar target in education, and we understand that in the budget environment you have, it's a pretty good target. But under that target, our school districts are looking at reducing their budgets by $150 million. This comes on top of $270 million in reductions over the last 2 years, which included about 1,700 staff layoffs. Members, we have a system right now funding education in Minnesota that is forcing your school districts, your public school districts, to take $550 million out of their general education revenue and spend it on mandated special education programs because we are totally failing as a state to provide special education funding. We have school districts that depend on 20% of their operating budget to come from a voter-approved operating referendum. I don't have to tell you, you all know it, because I'm sure you get the knocks at the door. You have parents and students selling gift paper, cookie dough, magazine subscriptions, trying to fund their public schools. So, Madam Chair, we believe that this $11 million, if you have an extra $11 million, it would be your duty to, in fact, send that money over to the Education Committee so they could do a little better job funding our public schools. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Mr. Kroonquist is very good at what he does, and I know you've got the numbers on you, and you gave us one of them. So if you describe that $11 million as a cut, what is that as a percentage, Mr. Kroonquist? What's in this budget environment, what is $11 million? Equal.
Madam Chair and Senator Michelle, it is less than 1%. And as I mentioned, we understand that that was hard work to you from you to get the target at that level. And we appreciate that in the budget environment we're in.
And Mr. Kroonquist, I would just add that the tuition tax credit is an after the fact credit to parents that have already made the choice to send their kids elsewhere and paid all the tuition. So there's no incentive here on anyone's part to change the current status of the numbers of students in the school or your sources of funding. There's no change at all.
Madam Chair, we recognize that, but it is $11 million that the state will be spending on this provision. And given the fact that we are not funding our public schools adequately, we think that that is money misdirected.
Mr. Kroonquist, is Ms. Alzwager here, or are you speaking on her behalf today? You are, Mr. Kite. Do you have additional comments?
Just a very few, Senator Ortman and members of the committee. I want to pick up on that after-the-fact issue, because earlier this tuition credit was characterized as addressing the issue of low-performing students under the achievement gap. It actually doesn't do that. It actually addresses lower-income parents, where it kind of lower to lower-middle-class parents. And just by nature of the after-the-fact thought, it kind of also implies then that this credit will go to students who are already choosing the private school. In a way, it becomes kind of a cherry-picking kind of a process as opposed to an open process that says, these children might need to go there. Now, that said, you've heard a little bit of comment from Mr. Kroonquist earlier. You heard some things about the constitutionality of this from Carolyn Jackson at ACLU. I just want to take a very, very brief other tact. This is a broader concern, and it's the unintended consequence concern. I happen to also be an individual who belongs to a church that supports a private school. So I work in the public sector, and I also understand the private environment. Here's the two unintended consequences that I'm somewhat fearful with. Number one, once we start making laws that start to provide directly or indirectly public money into private education, it is surely going to follow that those private schools are also going to have to adopt many of the regulations and laws that now are cover the public sector. I use the statement, with the king's purse comes the king. I think that from the private sector, they also have to be very careful of that. The second thing is this. Right now, there are a number of forms of providing some funding to families that are kind of around the edge of the constitutionality of the law, transportation, textbooks, and so forth. If we go down this tuition line, I'm afraid you're going to have a major lawsuit, which is then going to jeopardize many other forms of funding that are now being provided to parents more broadly. So that's another tack that I'd like just to bring up. In conclusion, we are just in opposition to this change, and we hope that somewhere down the line it becomes removed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kite. Members, I think we're going to make it by our 11 o'clock timeline. Hopefully, we'll keep forging through here and we'll not have to come back this evening. Next on the agenda, we have Ron Dicklich from the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools. And I think we should have, Frank Ongaro, right, as well, Mr. Ongaro. Mr. Dicklich, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for offering me an opportunity to speak today. My name is Ron Dicklich, and I am the Executive Director of the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools. And we are an association of 25 cities, 15 school districts, 10 townships, and 18 associate business members from the taconite relief area. And to start off, I'm not going to get too far in depth with issues that have already been discussed, but on top of LGA cuts from the past that have seriously strapped the operations of our cities, and in fact, in some of our cities, like the city of Hibbing, caused 15% to 20% of their staff to be laid off, there are additional cuts coming into the area that I think will be very detrimental to us. The disparity aid cut, we get a substantial amount of disparity aid in the area. There's seven counties that my region expands, and all of those counties have public lands. Anywhere from 60% of their land to 95% of the land in those counties are publicly owned. And I think somebody made the point before, and I would hope that in the future when we're going to buy more land that we have, we had this term that came up years ago called tails. I hope those tails will be accounted for when the state of Minnesota wants to acquire and purchase some more public land as far as PILT is concerned. A couple of things concern me in the minerals article. And I'm not going to address the part where, you know, they eliminate my association. I think I understand what that's about. But there's a part in the minerals article where you eliminate the escalator of the taconite tax. Now, the history of the escalator goes back to the mid-'80s when, in partnership with the industry, we sat down with them and reduced their base because times were very tough in the mid-'80s. We lost 15,000 employees in that industry and another 20,000 in related industries, and they were having a hard time. So we sat down with them, reduced their base, and then talked about the future. And since the taconite tax, and I know some of you have heard this over and over again, is in lieu of property tax, we tried to make some equity with the ability of other properties that pay property tax. They increase in market value. So how would we equate that? And so we agreed on an escalator for when times were good, because many times over the past when the industry's had some problems, for the past 25 years, that tax has been frozen. And in times when times are good, the escalator's gone on, so that reflects what other properties experience in increase in market value. And so the escalator is a very important part because it helps with the increase of values of property, what the values of property would be with regular property taxpayers. In the case of this, where the tax is paid in lieu of property tax. And so I'm a little confused why it's in here, because first of all, it doesn't help or hurt your budget problem. It doesn't increase or decrease the amount of state revenues you have. And I've talked to industry representatives, and they said they didn't request it, so maybe somebody can enlighten me why this is in here. The other thing I'd like to address is the taconite offset. And this has been around before, and it's been eliminated. And once again, this is history. I'm a history major, so I have to go back in history, and it goes back to my days in the Senate. And when the formulas were developed, the reality of the taconite tax is that when a ton of taconite is mined, it gets taxed one time. If you have the Mayo Clinic, you have 3M or Honeywell or some other property taxpayer, real property, They pay every year. But once that ton of taconite is mined, it gets taxed one time. And this is a finite resource. This doesn't go on forever and ever and ever. And the idea of the formulas was to address a couple of issues. That, which is a depletable resource, which the area will never get back, and hopefully that by collecting these taxes, we can spur other business development so that once the mining industry shuts down, as it has in other states over history, that we would have thriving communities. But secondly, because the effects of mining and what happens because mining is there, there are many public improvements that have to be made, public buildings that have to be built. And one example I'll share with you is that the Hibbing Taconite, which is right outside the city limits of Hibbing. Hibbing used to get their water from the Scranton Mine, an old natural ore pit. Well, as Hibbing Taconite started becoming short of taconite lands, they started moving into some old areas of the Hull Rust pit. And as a result of that, to mine that area in the old Hull Rust, they had to dewater. And when they dewatered, the level of the water source for the city of Hibbing, which is 18,000 people, became depleted. Now Hibbing has to go and dig and build new wells. Well, because of the in lieu of property tax situation, they don't pay extra for that. They don't pay on our school referendums. They don't pay if we put in new water and sewer, if we build a new public building or any facilities we put in. So that was a part of the reasoning that this taconite tax was along with the LGA and not subtracted from the LGA. And so I understand you're dealing with a budget situation, but I would just hope that in fairness to why those are there in the first place, you would reconsider these. And the fact that there's other bills going around here that are trying to take our property tax to balance the budget as well, I just hope and ask that you could reconsider these two parts of this budget. The freezing or the getting rid of the escalator, and then I noticed also you reduced the tax by a couple of cents. I don't know what that's about. And then on the taconite offset to LGA.
Just because of those things that you no longer talking about
there. Mr. Dicklich, thank you for your comments, and we'll look at it again. I mean, we'll continue to look at it. I do want to say that the escalator, that reform was recommended by the Taxpayers Association that did a nonpartisan review of the funding programs for the taconite taxes and the district. So it didn't come out of nowhere. It was a reform that has been recommended along with others that were not included in this bill at this time because they might have a disproportionate impact or one that might be piling on, if you will. And these are tough decisions we have to make. The entirety of the budget of the committee is property tax aids and credits. So if you're going to reach the target, and folks may not agree with the target, but the premise is if we're going to reach the target, you have to look at the entire budget and say what's the best way or the way that impacts folks the least in doing this. And that has been the effort of this committee working on this bill.
Madam Chair, that's the reason for getting rid of the escalator? Because the escalator has no impact on your budget.
Well, Mr. Dicklich, I did refer to the Taxpayers Association that recommended that, and the reasoning was that policymakers should always be engaged in that process when taxes go up. It shouldn't just automatically happen. We should take ownership of those changes. And there's no reason why folks can't come back and ask for an increase in those taxes instead of it automatically occurring without the checks and balances that ordinarily go with policy-making decisions.
Well, Madam Chair, just so for the record, you understand that with our partnership with the industry, we have recognized that, and when they shouldn't raise, we've frozen them. And in a time now when they're making record profits, it's not a time to freeze it. Because there may be a time where we have the early 80s again, and we have to go back and cut that base.
Thank you for your testimony,
Thank you,
sir.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach.
Kind of to the issue of helping the mining companies, it seems to me all the other businesses in the state are getting a reduction in the amount of taxes that they pay to the state's general fund, except the mines. Somehow the mines aren't getting treated like other businesses in the state. It seems like the fair thing to do, Madam Chair, if you want to help the mines, is let's phase out the occupation tax. That is general fund. That is general fund money that the mines pay to the state's general fund, no different than what commercial industrial property pay to the general fund through the state general tax. So, I mean, I think to be fair, this committee, if we're going to help other businesses in the state reduce their payment to the state general fund through the state general levy, it would be fair, I think, to phase out the occupation tax, which is the tax that the mining companies pay to the state general fund. Just a thought, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I care about this industry. It is the lion in northern Minnesota. It's a big piece of GDP, and I am a little hurt that we're doing something for all the other businesses in the state relative to the amount of money they pay to the state, but we're not doing anything for the mines, and I think in all fairness we should consider that.
Well, Senator Bach, we do have the repeal of the escalator, which is a reduction in their tax.
Madam Chair, that's easy for this committee to do because it only affects the Range cities. What I'm saying is all the other businesses in the state are getting a reduction from a payment to the general fund that the mines aren't getting. You're just asking the mines to take some money away from their local cities, while other businesses are all getting the opportunity to reduce their payments to the state. They're being treated differently.
Senator Bach, I would say they are already treated very differently. Mr. Ungawa.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Ungaro. I'm the Executive Director of Mining Minnesota. Mining Minnesota is the industrial trade association that represents the non-ferrous mining companies in Minnesota looking to produce copper, nickel, and precious metals in Minnesota. I'm here today on behalf of the industry to speak in support of the non-ferrous provisions that are included in the mineral tax article. Although they are primarily clarification in nature, they provide certainty that is extremely important to the companies as they look at continuing to invest hundreds of millions, even billions, in the state of Minnesota. And again, we support this provisions that are included in the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much for being here. Brian Rice is with us, and then we'll have Nan Madden from Minnesota Budget Project and Michael Dahl from Homeline after that. So, Mr. Rice, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm representing the Minneapolis Police Officers Federation and the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. I testified before the committee earlier this year, and I wanted to thank you, Madam Chair, for accepting Governor Dayton's recommendation on the pension aids and credits portion of your bill. These are programs that affect 11,000 police officers in the state through the Police State Aid Program, up for cities, counties, all state licensed officers, as well as tribal government and University of Minnesota officers. And essentially this aid supports their pensions and relieves those local jurisdictions of the cost of those substantially, as well as the Fire State Aid Program, which affects 2,000 full-time firefighters, most of whom that I'm speaking for on behalf of today, and 18,000 volunteer firefighters. And again, this dedicated state aid program to firefighters basically relieves local jurisdictions of substantial portion of their costs. So it's a local government aid program that's had a long, long history, as well as the amortization aid programs and the PRA aid program. So, Madam Chair, thank you for your committees doing that. And I know that you've been very helpful on state government committee, too, dealing with these pension questions as you delve into that. So we sincerely appreciate your help on those issues and keeping that system intact.
Mr. Rice, I appreciate your coming today. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Nan Madden from the Minnesota Budget Project. Ms. Madden, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a handout if the page could help me with that. The Minnesota Budget Project is an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues with particular attention to the impact that fiscal decisions have on low and moderate income Minnesotans. I'd like to testify today in strong opposition to the cuts in the renter's credit included in this bill. The renter's credit provides a property tax refund to over 300,000 low and moderate income Minnesota households across the state. 28% of the households receiving the renter's credit include seniors or people with severe disabilities. And in 16 counties in greater Minnesota, at least one half of the households receiving the renter's credit include seniors or people with disabilities. And the handout I brought today shows you the importance of the renter's credit in each county in Minnesota. The renter's credit is effective in meeting its goal, which is reducing the regressivity of the property tax system. A cut of this size severely hampers our ability to reduce the impact of those property taxes, especially at a time when rental property taxes are growing. You've already heard from one of the people who would be impacted by this cut today. The average cut under this bill is $170, and that's money that people use in their local communities for their basic needs. This proposal cuts the renter's credit by about 26% compared to its base. That's over $100 million in the biennium. We think it asks Minnesota's renters to contribute a disproportionate share of the solution to the state's budget shortfall. We recognize that there are tough choices before you and there will be cuts. But the cut target in this committee and in other committees has been made deeper in order to pay for the tax cuts that are in this bill. When we see the cuts to the renter's credit here, combined with the impact of cuts to services and other committees, we're concerned that the legislature's budget balancing plan asks low-income people, persons with disabilities, the elderly, and other vulnerable populations to play a disproportionate role in helping to solve the state's budget deficit.
Ms. Madden, thank you very much. I have Mr. Michael Dahl from Homeland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the Public Policy Director with Homeline. We're a statewide tenant advocacy organization, and I come to speak in opposition to the proposed cut to the renter's credit. Every year, Homeline hears from renters about how they use the renter's credit in their community and for themselves, and they use the renter's credit on basically the same things every year, basic necessities. As a previous testifier, Ernie McNeil, testified, the tax credit is not only used to help individuals meet their basic needs, but I'd ask you to consider how communities with a large number of renters, or any renters at all, how it impacts the community, the local community, and its economy when the tax credit is cut. We've asked renters what they use the tax rebate for. And I wanted to share with you some of the top 10 reasons. And I'm a prop guy, so I like to sort of make it really visual what it is we're talking about. The number one reason that people use the renter's credit, what they use the renter's credit for, is to catch up on bills. It's a basic thing. It's an obligation that they have. They use it to stock up on groceries, basic things, some things that they maybe stock up for the winter. They use it to buy clothing. I got a call from a renter actually just last week. She asked me specifically to talk to one of the representatives to say that she needed a new outfit so that she could apply for jobs. And the renter's credit is the type of thing that she uses to buy clothing when she needs it. Can't find my prop of eyeglasses, but eyeglasses are another thing that people use the renter's credit for. They use it to pay for insurance. They use it to pay for dental care that is not covered by insurance, prescriptions, a number of different things. And as I noted, this money is not just used by the individuals, but also is seen as a resource that's available to the local economy when they use it. Now, the renters who rate us, all they can do is tell us how they use the renter's credit. They don't see the bigger picture. They don't see that because they pay property taxes through their rent, they don't see how property taxes for them have increased over the past number of years. But because they don't see that, we can't report to you directly on how renters through this rebate are. If we're cutting this, we're actually making our tax system more regressive. And as Nan Ban pointed out, placing a higher burden on people who not only have fewer resources but are already paying more for the common good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Steve Peterson from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. You have been here all morning with us. Sorry for getting to you last, but that was the order of the agenda. And we'll have Mr. Mossman after that. And I think there's one other, I'm not sure I have your name, from NAMI, from NAMI, so we'll have you as well. Thank you. Mr. Peterson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Peterson, here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I will be brief, as many of testifiers have already talked about some of our issues that we have brought up today. First of all, the CGMC does support the extension of the TIF provisions that were in the jobs bill last year. We'd like to thank you for that. Overall, though, the CGMC does oppose the reductions in local government aid that are in the omnibus tax bill. If signed into law, the 2011 local government aid payments would be 25% less than that of what was paid in 2002. That is without inflation. The impacts of these cuts, there has been impacts due to the reductions in local government aid. According to the auditor report recently released, the 2009 city expenditure levels are 8% below what they were in 2000, adjusted for inflation, while city property taxes at the same time have increased 41%, or 100% if you don't include inflation. This, of course, has caused a reduction in local government employment, which has down 5% since 2002 for cities, counties, and townships, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In the last few years, this has accelerated in many of our cities due to the $310 million in reductions that have been since 2008. Waseca has seen a reduction in their workforce by 12%. Brainerd has cut 18 full-time positions, which is the equivalent of 20% of its workforce since 2008. Both those numbers from 2008. The math is simple. In general, if you reduce local government aids to cities, you will see a reduction in services or a property tax increase. The CGMC does support fully funding the certified 2011 LGA. We do not support reductions in the local government aid program, but we do understand if you're going to make reductions, it is easier to do that in the out year as opposed to the current year where we are cut halfway through our budget cycle again. The CGMC does not support the reduction of LGA offset for the sales tax. That is our current language. We do support continuing a strong statewide program based on city need and tax base. Even if LGA was funded at its certified 2011 level, that would still be 7% less than what it was paid in 2002 without inflation. For 40 years, LGA has been a strong part of the state and local partnership and has served Minnesota very well. Despite our incredibly long winters, which continue to today, and our short summers, Minnesota is a great place to be, and we believe that local government aid is part of that because it allows people and communities across the state, regardless of geography, regardless if they have a strong tax base or a low tax base or high needs, to have good quality city services without a huge disparity in tax rates if they have the same level of services. We hope that the decisions you make today will not only help ensure our communities are strong today, but also for the next 40 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Mossman? We'll have Mr. Schreiber.
Madam Chair and members, Matt Mossman, Minnesota Department of Revenue. Don't really have any prepared testimony for you this morning, members. We just wanted to go on record to say that we are still looking at the bill. We obviously will have some technical suggestions to language that we've started to assemble, and we'll find a way to bring those to the committee either now or prior to conference committee so that you have those suggestions and some tax administration and tax policy issues that we see in some provisions of the bill, and we'll bring those forward.
We would appreciate your assistance. Thank you very much, Mr. Mossman. Mr. Schreiber, and then Ms. Abderholder. Holden? Ms. Abderholder. Mr. Schreiber, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Schreiber, and I'm representing the Municipal Legislative Commission, which is 16 suburban communities in the metropolitan area. Starting from the northeast and go around the clock, it would be like Shoreview in the northeast, Woodbury in the east, Lakeville in the south, Shakopee in the southwest, and Maple Grove in the northwest. Our communities don't receive any local government aid, so we aren't here asking for anything other than we'd like to say good government. We, in our program for the session, the organization has been historically opposed to levy limits, and we're pleased to see that you do not include levy limits in the tax bill. There may be an argument for levy limits, but it's a time when the state is putting more money into aid to local units of government, and when the state wants to, or the legislature wants to make sure that those $8 are going to result in property tax relief and not more spending. Clearly, that's not the case this time. So the argument for levy limits seems to be not appropriate. Secondly, the one-year TIF extension is supported by our communities. There was a rather narrow window to put some of these programs together, so we appreciate the fact that you're including it in your bill. Most importantly is the market value homestead credit issue. You know, in Minnesota, we've had a long history, as compared to other states, of creating a bit of an incentive for home ownership, and it's worked. You've had, you know, in Minnesota, one of the highest rates of home ownership in the country. The history of it, going back to the old homestead credit, when the state was paying a percentage of the property taxes, it was found that it actually increased spending at the local level. Legislature said, hold on, that isn't working. And they went to HACA, a formula that few understood, but at least there was no incentive for additional local spending because the dollars were coming to the community. Then you went to the market value homestead credit, which is the program that our organization, the Municipal Legislative Commission, really strongly supported, because it made so much sense. It didn't make any difference if you lived in International Falls or Edina. There was a reduction based upon the market value of the home, and that seemed like it made a lot of sense. The problem became is that that the dollars for that market value homestead credit, which was to be a reimbursement from the state to the cities, became, whether you call it the budget reserve or a cash flow account or whatever for the state, the fact is our municipalities only received their reimbursement from the state 1 out of 10 years. So what was intended to be a good program became a very unstable source of funding for our cities. And this last fall, our mayors and managers got together and they said either eliminate the program or do it differently, because what is going on currently simply is not working. You've chosen to eliminate the program, still giving that benefit to individual homeowners, a differentiation between the homeowner and the non-homesteaded property, and we think Minnesota has a long history of that, and you're continuing it. So that's good. Our organization also said if you eliminate it, then make sure you increase the property tax refund so that those individuals who are in most need, and that is the amount of property taxes that they're paying in relationship to their income, that the state makes some adjustment for that. And you've done that in the bill as well. So we think you're going in the right direction here. As it relates to local government aid, we don't receive any, but our communities do say, have a program that we can tell our constituents as to why we don't receive local government aid and some other cities do. You haven't reached that point, but you have time to do it, and we'd encourage you to do it. I think it's also appropriate that adjusting the expectations downward from the $527 million to a $426 is appropriate, because it appeared that the $527 is simply not sustainable. So during the next year, we would encourage you to work on those formula dollar amounts. You fix the amount of dollars that you think is appropriate going out to aid cities, but then we'd also encourage a formula that is understandable. So with that, thank you, and if you have any questions, be happy to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiber. Appreciate your testimony. Senator Pogue-Miller.
Mr. Schreiber, I generally agree with almost everything you just said. Doesn't it give you, with your history, doesn't it give you a bit of concern, though, that this is particularly a time to bring the $500 billion down because it's not sustainable? When you see the overall charts that show that the property tax is becoming our largest source of income in the state, doesn't that give you some pause that maybe we have started to hit that limit?
Mr. Schreiber.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Pogemiller, I think anyone that studied tax policy understands the importance of the three-legged stool and having some balance between sales tax, income tax, and property tax. From the city standpoint, the property tax is it's a very, very reliable source of income. So that's a benefit. Having that too far out of line, of course, should be of concern. I think balance is important.
Madam Chair, my question was, do you think the balance is correct now, or do you think it's getting out of whack? Because if you look at the historical trend over the last 30 years, we had been, as a state, able to hold property taxes roughly to the inflationary increase. That is starting to get away from us now. And I think with the depression of the housing market, I think we are kidding ourselves if we don't think there's been a real aggressive push on the property taxes in the last few years here. What's the housing market? Maybe the housing market values will never come back. But if they do, I think that chart showing what's going on with property taxes is going to really take off again. It just seems logical that that's what's going to happen. And we'll be back to 1970.
Madam Chair and Senator Pogemiller, I think you need to look at property taxes as a percentage of market value, the effective tax rate. That's the way it's ranked in other states. I think, you know, we're in a situation where Minnesota is not an island, and you need to look at not only the property tax but all your taxes as to how you relate to other states in the country, and if you get too far out of line, is it going to have an impact on your ability to develop jobs and so on? Quite frankly, our property tax, effective tax rates in Minnesota, at least for homestead properties, are not out of line with the rest of the country. In fact, they're in the lower half. You can become more sensitive as it relates to the business property taxes. And I think the key question there is, does that have an impact on locational decisions for the business community? My guess it does not, as you're relating to retailers, because they want to respond to a market. As it relates to manufacturers and some other types, it may, and I think one has to be sensitive to that.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiber. Ms. Abder Holden. Is our last testifier this morning. Mr. Matthews was here also. I think he left because, oh, there you are, Mr. Matthews. You've had folks here from the counties that have testified already, but if you have additional comments, you would be welcome as well. Ms. Abder-Holden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abder-Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and we're a grassroots organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families. I hadn't planned to testify until I heard there had been a discussion about the mental health maintenance of effort, and I just wanted to provide some additional information on that. You know, most of the disability community has relied on medical assistance for paying for treatment and services. That has not been true for people with mental illness for a number of reasons. One is that it's actually harder to get on medical assistance if you have a mental illness. It's sometimes cyclical. It's very difficult to get on Social Security and prove that you have a permanent disability and cannot work. So we have fewer people on medical assistance. Even if you get on medical assistance, I think it's important to remember there's something called the IMD exclusion, which is an institute for mental disease. Medicaid will not pay for those services. That includes places like Anoka and anything over 15 beds. Additionally, we've had trouble getting treatment paid for. Mental health parity, for example, you know, only recently came in on the federal level. That does not require mental health services to be covered. Only if you decide to cover them, you cover them in the same way. So we still have a lot of people who aren't covered there. When the maintenance of effort went into effect, it came about because for the first time the state was actually going to try to fund mental health services in a better and it was kind of through a reform effort. It was a bipartisan effort in 2007. We actually added a series of services and treatments onto the medical assistance package that had previously been paid for by counties. The legislature did not want to simply supplant those dollars because we knew the mental health service system was solely underfunded, so they said, no, we need to keep those dollars there. Right now, it represents about $110 million, close to 15% of the total funding for our mental health system. I also want to make sure that you understand that in 2009, we did get together with counties who said, you know, we're kind of hard-pressed here. And so there's actually a release valve in the mental health maintenance of effort that says if your state and federal dollars are reduced, you can reduce your mental health maintenance of effort in a proportional way. So we do have that valve there if state and federal dollars go down. I would say that it would be very difficult if you were to, you know, add this in as the House did. We opposed the House bill. This is not the time to, frankly, pull the rug out on the mental health system. $110 million is a lot of money that, you know, really helps people. When I look at it in conjunction with, for example, the Senate Health and Human Services bill, we've lost over, in that bill, $35 million in the state grants that went to support and supplant and kind of improve our mental health system. When we put in the services under medical assistance, we also put them under Minnesota Care and General Assistance Medical Care. Those will be wiped out in the bill as well. So we're looking at a potential, frankly, decimation of our mental health system. And if we lose the few county dollars that we have, I really don't know what will happen. I would disagree in terms of saying that the needs of people with mental illness are always on the top. They're not. I think that's been true for a long time. Our system is very underfunded. We have over 500 people die by suicide a year. We have a majority of the people who are homeless have a serious mental illness. I think if you were to call your local sheriff or police chief, they will tell you that their jails, 60% of the people in their jails, 25% in the prisons. We are not a Cadillac system by any stretch of the imagination. So I would hope that, you know, this would not be an amendment that would appear sometime, because I think it actually would deserve a full discussion on the impacts and the implications for both children and adults with mental illnesses. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. You're a great advocate for your organization.
Thank you.
Members, questions, comments? Well, we've made it through the agenda, so there's no compelling reason to come back at 6 o'clock. Oh, Mr. Matthews, you do have additional comments. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the latitude to just make a few quick comments. Just 2 points of clarity in response to Ms. Abderholden's testimony. The flexibility she mentioned does exist, but that expires at the end of the current year, and so that is going away. And the other piece, just to clarify, relieving us of the MOE does not alleviate us of our responsibility to provide mental health services. For example, Washington County is anticipating that they will be out of compliance with the MOE, even though they have not changed the level of service they provide. And so what we're really talking about is trying to get down to really focusing on, give us the clarity of what the outcomes are, what the services you want provided, but don't set a flat dollar amount that we have to spend regardless of what the situations are locally. And so we'd be happy to have this conversation further as the committee continues to deliberate, but I just wanted to add those 2 points of clarity. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Matthews. Members, we will meet again tomorrow at 9:30 and take up amendments as we've previously discussed. Thank you for being here today. This meeting is adjourned.